Welcome to the Talk Radio.
This is All About Wine.
This is All About Wine.
Dedicated
to the wine industry since 2009. Featuring winemaker, cellar master, vineyardist, and tasting expert, Ron.
Basically, what we're trying to do on the program is just trying to educate people and trying to make wine less confusing and more friendly.
From coast to coast. And around the world.
You know, we've really have some neat people on the program. I love that.
Post your questions and comments during the live show on our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/allaboutwinebtr. Again, that's www.facebook.com/allaboutwinebtr. And now, All About Wine is on. Here's Ron.
Thank you. Okay, Mike, I unplugged it, turned it back on, hit copy, and it came out a blank sheet again.
Oh, God. All right. As a final step, unplug both printers, go to Best Buy with a credit card or cash. Tell them you want their top-of-the-line printer and minimum $800-$900 bucks.
And I want cartridges to be cheap.
Well, they got a color laser printer at work. I think the whole thing was maybe, I don't know, $900 bucks or something. It's a pretty good size. It does everything. It's all laser color and everything. And to order cartridges for it, the cartridges are $400 a piece, I think.
Whoa.
So if you bought all the cartridges, it almost cost the price of the printer. It's like, how ridiculous is that? So that tells me they're putting $900 of print cartridges in this thing and $50 worth of hardware. Doesn't make any sense.
And you start looking at the amount of ink that they use in it. They use probably about 50 cents worth of ink. Yeah. They're spraying on those papers. Yeah. I know, ink cartridges are outrageous. All right, well, we have talked about, got a phone call coming in. We got a guest tonight, and so we are we were sitting there killing a couple of minutes until he contacted us, but he's sitting there. Thatcher Baker Bridge is our guest. He is, well, a lot of things, and so instead of letting me trying to tell you everything that he is and what he does, we'll get him to tell us himself. Hello, Thatcher.
Hey,
thank you. Welcome to All About Wine.
How are you?
I'm doing great tonight.
Thanks for letting me join. I'm excited to have a good conversation with you guys.
It is our pleasure having you on. We appreciate it that you're taking the time out to join us. The first thing I want to ask you is did you get the name Thatcher? That is rather unusual. I don't think I've ever heard that before.
I wish I had a really good story for you. And like maybe it was like my family was from the UK and they just loved Margaret Thatcher. But I don't really have a good story. My parents they liked the name and it clicked that's the story. I wish I had a better one for the name.
So basically what you're saying is your parents are children from the 60s who had a child, and they were saying, all right, let's call him Thatcher. And so that's what they did.
almost, but 70s parents, actually. So, yeah.
70s cat. Works, too. 70s works, too.
Exactly.
I just wondered. I've never heard the name before, and I thought it was rather unusual, and that's why I was – just curious of where it came from.
I've never met anyone named Thatcher either in real life. It's funny when I say, hey, my name is Thatcher, people automatically think that I say Patrick. And so I have to say, oh, no, Thatcher, like Margaret. And as I get a little older, the amount of people that don't know who Margaret Thatcher is starting to become a little concerning.
That's true. Yeah, it's becoming more and more. Or Thatcher, maybe, the romance novels that you hear with the hunk on the cover and the girl in the flowing gown. Thatcher sounds like a name for one of the characters there, too.
I'll take it if it's the hunk, for sure.
Okay. All right. I just, you know, we're you know, getting out of tangent here. But it's a name, though. I'm you know.
No.
Obviously, you've gotten used to it all the years, so it doesn't tend to be an issue with you. But I just was curious where it came from. So,
So
you are involved in lots of stuff. I was quite impressed. Your publicist, I guess, was Alicia, sent me a biography, I guess, of what
right.
you've done and what you've been doing and your life. Instead of me going through everything and all that, I want you to tell us how you got to where you are now, what you do now, how you got to where you are now, and all the, your history, if you will.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It's been a long life, but a short life still, I guess. I'm still quite young. So, I got into food when I was really young, and it was just kind of came from, I don't really actually know where it came from, because I didn't really grow up in like a very food-oriented family. But when I got the bug, I just kind of dove in and was really passionate about different ingredients, different culture, cooking techniques. And I started reading and kind of tasting and trying to cook and watching the Food Network. And eventually, sometime around 10, 11, I kind of said to myself, hey, I know that I want to work in restaurants. I want to be a chef. This is what I want to do.
Yeah, but see, so often, if I can interrupt you, so often,
yeah,
I mean, at 10, 11 years old, you know, I want to be an astronaut. I want to be a cowboy. I want to be a fireman. I mean, most people, well, I want to be a chef. And they say, yeah, okay, that's nice. Can run along and play. I mean, to grasp it at that age is really, and to hold on to that dream is really unusual in itself.
Yeah, I don't know. If anybody that knows me knows that I'm one of the most persistent people probably. But it's funny, like nothing's ever changed for me, food and now wine, which I think really go hand in hand. There's never been a moment where I've said, you know, I'm tired, the hours are too long, the pay is not good enough. None of those things have ever come up. I've never said I'm bored of this. It's just there's really nothing else in the world that I would ever really want to do other than work in food, wine, and like sort of hospitality, if you will. So, I was lucky. I mean, really lucky, and I've just been for the past, I guess, so I started working in restaurants when I was 13 and now being 30. So it's, I guess, you know, 17 years. And I've just always tried to take in and absorb as much as I possibly could along the road. So when I was 13, I started as a dishwasher in Windsor, Ontario. I'm Canadian. That didn't last long because I just kind of was always poking my head around the corner from the dish pit and curious what was going on on the line. And the chefs would always say, oh, come, like, we'll teach you something. And started rising up the ranks in the restaurant in Windsor. And by the time I was around 16 or so, I was pretty much running the kitchen, helping them to open another restaurant, learned a lot in a really short period of time. And from there,
well,
went to spend a couple of
again,
years.
Again, if I may interject.
Of course.
What about school?
Absolutely.
I mean, you know, does the Canadian school system say, okay, this boy here is going to be a chef and the rest, so we'll let him skip school and go do this. Well, what were you doing, you know, doing school at the same time as all this?
Yeah, I mean, I was doing school for kind of the beginning part of it. When I was in high school, we basically kind of found a way. There was a way in Canada that you could kind of get credits by like trade credits, if you will.
Huh.
And so we kind of figured it out. I don't know how I did it, But I also think that the principal and the teachers were like, okay, like, we'll figure something out for you. Like, we see what's going on here. And so, yeah, I ended up getting credits from working in restaurants and you know, the labor laws, I'm not so sure, but there were definitely some exceptions that were made. And I was extremely lucky to get such an early start because I think in any other world, or even maybe just a few years later, I probably would have had to wait until I was, you know, 16, most likely, to be able to, like, actually work in a restaurant. But back then, you can get it was, like, legal in, like, starting at 12, I think, or 13 was, like, the legal age in Canada that you could actually start and have a job. Wow. So I was really lucky. Yeah. Yeah. I don't think it's like that anymore, but it was at least back then. So.
Wow. That's cool.
Yeah. And then once I got into the kitchen, you know, that was it for me. I just was like, I need to always kind of push myself and put myself in kind of unique situations. So after spending 4 years at what was really the sort of fine dining restaurant in the city, I moved on to work at a sushi restaurant for a couple of years. And I've always been really kind of interested in Japanese food and flavors. And, you know, once in a while, on a lucky day, you know, my mom would take me out for sushi or something. And that was really kind of interesting. And so when I actually started working at a sushi restaurant, I kind of really fell in love with, you know, Japanese food. And that kind of comes back to play years later. And then after spending, you know, turning 18, I basically said, all right, mom, I'm going to Europe. Well, jumped on a plane on my, like, 18th birthday, spent a couple of months in Europe with all the money that I had kind of saved up from working for, you know, those years.
And it lasted for 2 months.
Right, yeah. And then it was barely 2 months. Yeah. I think I might have called my mom halfway through and being like,
you know, all that money I had saved up? Well.
Yeah, it's gone. Yeah. So I flew into Italy and kind of just traveled around. I mean, I flew into Venice and made my way down south, went to Sweden, went all over France. And obviously, you know, being 18, didn't quite have the means to, you know, do all the Michelin starred restaurants, but it was really amazing to kind of experience the culture you know, go to the markets and see the way that people live and eat. And it just being there alone at 18 just made me say, hey, I need to do something like grand. I need to do something big. I need to make big moves. And so as soon as I got back, I said, hey, mom, there's this chef in Vancouver. And Vancouver is obviously, it's on the other side of Canada.
Yeah.
And I just heard that he moved to Vancouver. And I'm going to move there, and I hope I'll get a job. And that was kind of the conversation that we had. And she's like, what are you talking about? And I was like, I just need to go there because I want to work for this chef. And his name was Warren Garrity. He was the right-hand man for Marco Pure White. And so he had this really amazing story, and I was really interested in his food. And somehow I moved there, and he hired me. And it's funny because you brought up my name and the fact that it's Thatcher. I think to this day that was the reason that I got the job there, because he said to me, he said, I don't know if it's you're a good cook or if I'm just a big fan of Maggie. He's like, but I'm going to hire you. Pretty funny. So.
Yeah, it is.
And it was an amazing kitchen to work in. The restaurant is called, it's still open, I believe. It's called West. And they were always at the kind of forefront of the food that was being made in Canada. It was a really, really intense kitchen, very European oriented, learned a ton in a very sort of rigid, old school cooking. Like, sort of imagine if you've ever watched those Gordon Ramsay shows back in the day. It was very much along those same lines. So learned a lot, built up a tough skin, that's for sure. And then when he departed West, I was kind of like, well, I moved to Vancouver to, you know, work with you. And I was kind of looking around the city and ended up finding another chef that I was had kind of been following in Toronto, which is back on the East Coast, I guess.
Yeah, the coast, right.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of like, it's not on the East Coast, but definitely more east than it was west. And so he was doing some really incredible stuff at his restaurant at the time called Splendido. And he was doing this sort of Asian fusion thing that wasn't yet Asian fusion. It was still kind of figuring out what it was. And he was just doing amazing things. And so I jumped back to Ontario and took a position with him. Again, super lucky that he wanted to hire me. And it was a really interesting change of pace for me. So the last couple of restaurants that I had worked at have all been really kind of small and intimate. And this was a monster of a restaurant. We were doing 600 people a day.
Wow.
In like a very fine dining format. It was honestly, when I look at it now, after, you know, all of the experiences that I've had, I'm still kind of blown away by what we were able to do at this restaurant. And then from there, you know, I just kind of said, well, what am I going to do now? You know, I've been at this restaurant for a few years, and I want more. I want to be out of my comfort zone. I want to be challenged. What am I going to do? And I said, the thing that Canada's lacking is Michelin stars. It doesn't have any. And I think that that's something that I need to understand and need to experience. And so I kind of made a short list of restaurants all around the world that I was really curious to work for. I had been following the chef, and I emailed Qua, which is was a two Michelin star restaurant here in San Francisco, and I had been following the chef Daniel Patterson for quite a long time because he was really doing something that now is incredibly popular, but back in the day, I mean, he was at the forefront of it, and he was doing all these foraging and focusing on vegetables and really local products and not doing these tasting menus based off of truffles and foie gras and caviar. It was more things like oysters and different like broccolis, cauliflowers, brassicas, we called it. And so I sent them an email, and they responded right away, and I said, okay, I'm coming. So I went and I spent a week with them, and they offered me a job, and I figured out how to move to the U.S. And luckily, I have a U.S. passport because my dad is American, so I kind of lucked out. Otherwise, I don't know if I – honestly, it's so hard to move to the U.S. Otherwise, even with experience, like it's really challenging. And so I kind of lucked out there. And that was kind of my entry point into wine. It was a very small restaurant. We worked at a really high level. But because it was so intimate, at the end of the night, you sometimes get to – you know, taste wines that were open or poured or left or whatever. And, you know, I didn't really know anything. I tasted and I said, oh, that's interesting. Like, I've never tasted anything like this before. But I think a lot of times when you cook, you really just focus on what's happening in the kitchen, you know, and after work you have a beer or whiskey or whatever, and you don't necessarily pay attention to the service of things. And so, you know, that's what kind of sparked my interest, were some moments there. But it wasn't until the next position that I ended up going back to Canada for about maybe 6 months, 9 months to help the original restaurant that I worked for. They were completely renovating everything. And they wanted some help. They're like, oh, you worked at a Michelin star restaurant. Like, why don't you come back and sort of give us your input and help us do this? And that's when he was asking my opinion on wine, and I was like, well, I don't know. And
I would
call the sommelier. Yeah, I would call the sommelier at Qua, and I would say, like, hey, like, what is this? And he would try to explain it to me, and then, like, and I still had no idea what he was talking about. And so then I was like, well, now I feel crazy. I've spent 10 years working in restaurants. I want to own a restaurant, but I don't know anything about service and I don't know anything about wine. And I need to change that. That's not okay with me, with me. And so I just put my head in the books and I just studied for sometimes on my days off, I would spend, 10, 12 hours just reading and maybe just like tasting wines. And I just became obsessed and it was something that I just couldn't, I never could get out of it. I never wanted to get out of it. And so I think from that point, and about 6 months later, I went through the intro sommelier exam with the quartermaster sommeliers and then passing the certified exam. And I was, I think 20, it was like 22 when I passed.
Wow.
And it was amazing. I mean, it's such an interesting, path. And I think for anybody that goes down it, I think it's really fascinating. And it also allows you to kind of take away, what you want out of it. You can really go down so many different paths with it. You don't need to become a master, or you can become a master, it's really up to you. And so, that was amazing. And I took the exam in New York, and, when I got back, I was just like, I need to be in a place like that. Like, I need to be in a place where there's people and there's access to wine, because there's amazing wine in Canada, but everything is province controlled. So it all goes through, in Ontario, goes through the LCBO. So there's amazing wine that goes to Ontario, but there's also a ton of wine that it's impossible to get in Canada. And so I said, hey, I need to learn about wine more and I need to be more involved in service. And so I went back to San Francisco and, I didn't have a job when I went back, but I felt okay. I felt like I was going to find something that really fit what I was looking for. And ended up taking the job at Saison. And at the time, it was a 2-Michelin-star restaurant, and the chef had been on my radar for a really, really long time. And, when I applied, naturally, they said, well, yeah, I mean, we could definitely hire you in the kitchen. And I was like, well, no, I don't want that. I work in the dining room. I want to be a sommelier. I want to work with wine. And they're like, well, you have zero front of the house experience. And I was like, oh, yeah. So they're like, well, you could start at the bottom. But they're like, you've been doing this for 10 years already. And I was like, I don't care. I'll start at the bottom. I'll learn everything because, like, honestly, I don't even know what side of the fork I'm supposed to put on, put the fork on the table, right?
Right.
So, I mean, and I really was excited to work at Saison because they were looking at things so much differently. They were looking at service from a very comfortable way. They wanted to give you a 3-Michelin-star service, but they wanted it to give you the things that you needed as opposed to just the way that it's always done. And I think for me, that was really interesting. They had an amazing wine list. At the time, probably 3,000 selections on the wine list.
Wow.
Mostly Burgundy. It was honestly the cellar was, this was in 2014, and the cellar was incredible. I mean, you could pretty much name any producer, any vineyard and in vintage in Burgundy, and it was probably on the list or very close to it. And then the food was outrageous. I mean, everything was cooked over an open fire. You sat in the kitchen. It was just such a fun restaurant to work in. There was 80s music playing. It was just like nobody ever knew what was going on, except it was just so much fun.
How many tables?
7 tables in the dining room. It's really
7?
Small.
Wow.
Yeah, we served about 50 guests a night is kind of what we did for covers. It was tiny. And at the time, it was one of the most expensive restaurants in the U.S. I think the only other two restaurants were that were more expensive were Masa in New York, which is 600-800, and then Urasawa, which is now closed in L.A., but yeah, the tasting menu back in 2014 was like $390 or something, $320 per person, which was double what was normal in 2014. Now that's normal, but back then everybody was like, "Who are these people?"
Why do they think they can get this? Yes.
Right? Yeah, it was crazy, and it was always a topic. But then people would come, and it was so much fun, and they're like, "Okay, fine, I get it." and it was so. What was great about that time was, you know, we had two Michelin stars, and we were working for our third Michelin star, and there was just nothing that was going to get in our way of getting that third Michelin star. And there was so much energy and buzz, and people were talking about the restaurant that we were opening. Just, you know, I mean, we were drinking so well, and because it was such a small, intimate restaurant, people weren't like, "Well, let me pour you a little taste of this wine." They're like, "Here, have a glass of the wine. Like, I want you to drink this. I want you to enjoy it," which sometimes got you into trouble. But like, we were opening DRC all the time, Costa Rica. We were drinking. I mean, I don't even know how many times we had the 82 first gross. Like, they were just being open.
Wow,
it was just nuts. And so it was really a sort of expedited route for me in terms of learning about Burgundy, because you start to actually drink these wines so often that it's not just about reading them in a book. It's about understanding bottle to bottle the differences and the variations, and you start to gain a little bit of an opinion on these things. And so that was really, really incredible. After we got our third Michelin star, which was pretty amazing, you know, the decision for me was kind of like, so I had been there for about 2 years at the time, and I had a choice to make. I could have moved into a director of something, director of service, whatever position, or I could have put myself in another position that, you know, with my same ethos of how the rest of my life has been, is like kind of being outside of my comfort zone. And so I sat back and kind of thought about it. And when I said to you, I developed this fondness for Japanese food.
Right.
It was very crude, because I then just decided to move to Japan without a job.
Japan. Do you speak any Japanese?
I do now, but I didn't at the time. So, yeah, I just was like, all right, I've worked at some nice restaurants. Like, I love Japanese food. Well, I mean, why wouldn't I move there?
Only makes sense. There you go. Yeah,
it only makes sense. Yeah. And I would never give anybody that piece of advice, to just, if you want to live in Japan, just go live in Japan. But, I got there and found an apartment, and then realized I don't have a job. And I was like, huh. Emailed a couple restaurants, and I had met Chef Takazawa and his wife Akiko actually at Saison, and never really thought anything of it, but I had their email, and so I said, oh, you know, they're doing incredible things. It's such a special restaurant in Japan. That's really interesting. And so I sent them an email, and they said, yeah, come on by. And we spent a couple of hours just walking around the restaurant. And I say this, but walking around the restaurant, there's only three tables in the entire restaurant. They serve 10 guests tonight. So there's not really walking around. It was
You're not walking
kind of
around
like,
much. They're very
kind of
slowly.
Exactly, yeah, very slowly. And they were like, these are the wine glasses that we use. And, like, you know, this is our menu, and this is the wine list. And they had a really cool wine list. Like, they had they served 10 guests tonight, and they had about 70 selections on their wine list, which is pretty good amount of wine. And, you know, so we were talking, and I was like, this is so cool. Like, I would love to be a part of this. And so I accepted the job there, started working just a few days later. And I actually started working in the kitchen there. And I was at a crossroads. I said to myself, like, I'm in Japan. I love Japanese food. I would be so happy to just cook again and kind of learn all of these things. And then the other side, I love wine. And, you know, I would also do that. And so what was interesting about Takazawa was, because it was such a small restaurant, he was the chef and sommelier. And for me, that was so inspiring, that I was like, well, whatever happens, I'm going to be happy because I'm still involved in everything. And so I spent some time cooking, and then there was an instance where some guests had come into the restaurant, and they were celebrating a going away party or something. And they had asked, hey, can you recommend, some wine to the chef? And he was like, he was kind of busy. And he's like, Thatcher, can you go talk to them? And they ended up ordering all of this incredible wine. And at the end of the night, the chef was just like, can you do this always? And I said, yeah, for sure. And so I ended up taking over the wine program for them. So, which was really interesting. Japan, the wine culture, it's obviously not something that I think, people think about. When you think about Japan and you go out to eat Japanese food, you think about sake, you think about beer, you don't really think about wine. But I haven't been back in a couple of years now, obviously with last year and this year, but I would say that there's more incredible bottles of wine from the 60s, 70s, 80s in Japan than probably anywhere. Like, they bought so much Burgundy in the 70s that it's still, to this day, like, stacked to the ceilings in some of these cellars. And the provenance of them is unparalleled. I mean, it's insane. Like, anything that you want, if you're like, oh, Henri Jaillet, I mean, I know somebody there that has cases and cases and cases that he bought on release. It's crazy. It's insane. It's just such an obsessive culture that I love so much that when they love something, they just buy everything and they just go for it. And, yeah. So that was such an amazing experience for me being there. And, I thought being in this 3-Michelin-star restaurant in San Francisco at Saison and like drinking all of this incredible wine, like, I was like, I'll never experience Burgundy like this again. And then when I was in Japan, I was like, wow, like, I'm drinking and tasting so much better than I had ever thought was even possible. And being a 3-table restaurant, like, and it's so funny. So it's a 3-table restaurant, and generally speaking, 1 table is always for regular guests. So if you see the same people all of the time, and they would come on a sometimes weekly basis and always be drinking incredible things. And so just experiencing wine there really, I think looking at what I do now, that was really a huge step for me because it, I had mentioned this a little bit prior, like it helped me gain opinions on vintages and producers and vineyards and those kind of things. And so that was really special. And then, eating sushi all the time was also I won't complain about that. I spent a few years there. And then like living in any foreign country, kind of ran into some visa complications. And at the same time, the chef from Saison, Josh, had called me and was like, what are you doing? Like, when are you coming back to the U.S.? And he had all these ideas and concepts that he was working on. And he's like, I'd love for you to be a part. And so I said, okay. And, as the visa complications continued, I decided to leave and come back to San Francisco. And
before you leave Tokyo, did do another test though and became another sommelier.
In sake, which was so much fun. It was really fun to study for because sake is kind of complicated because there's not really rules. Like, you can kind of do whatever you want. Kind of like beer. Like, it's hard to, like, you can't put coffee in sake, but, like, you can really do a lot of different things that people don't really think about, different yeast types, water types, different polishing rates. And so it was really fun to taste all of these different sakes because none of that stuff is available here in the U.S. People think that sake is, you know, 16% alcohol, 17, 18% alcohol, but there's producers in Japan that are making things with, you know, 9, 10, 11% alcohol, and then are totally different than anybody, you know, would think of. And so it's really fun to do it. And it's an interesting exam. I mean, it's not dissimilar from the certified exam. There's no service element. There's a blind tasting and then a pretty long theory exam. I think the theory exam is like 4 or 5 hours. It's a pretty long exam.
Wow.
But fun. And like, I think, you know, I don't know if it's available in the U.S. yet, but I would highly recommend anybody that works in a Japanese restaurant or even is just kind of passionate or interested in learning about it. It's worth studying for a year. And then if you take a vacation to Japan, you know, putting a day or two aside for taking it, you know, because you meet a lot of people along the way too that are interested in sake, and it opens up a lot of doors in Japan, which can often be closed, for you to go to breweries or meet people that are really influential in sake in Japan. So it's really fun.
I've never heard of a sake sommelier. I you know, just it seemed new. Well, Kikizaki Shai was,
yeah,
that?
Yeah, exactly. Kikizaki Shai.
Yeah, I've never heard of that.
Slowly but surely, it's starting to gain some, like, sake is starting to gain some relevance. And I want it to more. I think the access to sake in the U.S. is part of the problem. It's a storage thing. A lot of the distributors and such don't take very good care of sake, and it's a really, really sensitive product. It should be stored at below zero, actually, like long-term storage. For anything longer than really just a few months, that anything longer than 6 months, it really should be stored in below, like -1, -2 is the ideal storage temperature for it. Otherwise,
talking,
it starts to develop.
Are we talking Celsius or are we talking Fahrenheit?
That would be Fahrenheit, right? Is that
okay.
Right? Yeah,
United States is Fahrenheit. You know, you're Canadian, so that is Celsius. Yeah, that's why.
Exactly. Sometimes I get confused with it. Yeah, a lot of the great brands don't get exported from Japan because the U.S. market isn't designed yet, at least to be set up to care for these, you know, really sensitive beverages, and it's too bad because it could be, but it's. To be honest, the way that they would, you know, the optimal storage that they would like is so expensive. It's we're just not set up for it yet. But there's a couple of great.
I was just going to say, I enjoy sake, and I usually have a couple of them on hand all the time, but I've never been told, I've never heard that these things should be stored at such a cold temperature. That surprises me, tremendous surprise.
If you open it, I mean, you can keep it in the fridge and keep it in the fridge for, even with this, if it's open, it's good for a couple of weeks for sure. It will obviously change, depending on what the sauce. I just would never keep it outside of the fridge for any sort of extended period of time.
Wow.
And keep it standing up. Keep it standing up just like you would with like Madeira or with like a spirit, it is a little bit higher alcohol content, so it will start to like corrode the what is often metal capsule.
Correct.
Yeah.
Oh, wow, that's interesting. I never realized that about sake. Like I say, I enjoy sake. It's one of my that and scotch are two of my usually higher alcohol pleasures, and sake obviously not being that high, but I just never realized that it was that sensitive, and I've never had some very real Japanese sake, so that could be part of it too.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it doesn't get enough stress sometimes in the sense that, like, sake is one of the most food-friendly beverages there is. And, I pretty much all sake will work with food, and it works with everything from, obviously, you know, Japanese things like sushi. But, I mean, there's sakes that work really nicely with grilled chicken, grilled steak. I mean, there's a lot of options with what it pairs really nicely with. And it's cool to see a lot of Michelin-starred restaurants starting to maybe, you know, in the wine pairing or something, starting to, you know, pour a sake or two for people. And it often is kind of like, oh, wow, it can sometimes be the biggest surprise of the entire wine pairing because nobody's, you know, expecting it. They're expecting a champagne, two white wines, two red wines, sweet wine, you know, same thing.
Exactly.
Same wine everywhere. So yeah. It's fun to kind of shake it up a little bit. So.
Wow. I'm sorry. Yeah. I noticed the little note here that you are a kikisakishi, and so I just wanted to learn a little bit about that, but that was interesting. I learned a lot more than I thought I would about sake. So you were lured back to San Francisco, where you left before I interrupted.
Yeah, was lured back, so Saison was kind of going through some transitioning. The chef Joshua, who kind of was stepping out of the limelight a little bit and moving on to open a couple of new concepts called Angler, one in San Francisco, one in LA, which was meant to kind of be this not fine dining, but also kind of fine dining, but like fun seafood restaurant that you could go to for like a casual oysters salad and, you know, a steak, or you could go there and like have this, you know, long 3-hour experience with, you know, a whole turbo and all of these really cute sort of like raw fish preparations and all these beautiful vegetables and kind of things. And so, you know, I helped with that entire opening, which was a really cool experience for me. I had opened a few restaurants before, but for me, kind of being, you know, involved in the entire process was really unique. And I came back as it was kind of a made up position in a sense. It was, you know, the title was like Director of Service and Beverage. And my job was really to connect all of the different aspects of the restaurant. So take the wine team and the service team and the chefs and bring them all together and create systems to kind of provide better service for the guests. And that's kind of what I was doing. And it was really fun. I mean, I kind of just I just looked at how we do things and tried to see if there was a better way to do it, whether efficiently or just from a like purely hospitality focused degree. So it was a really amazing position. And being back, it was great to be reunited with a lot of the sort of regular guests that I had known for years from you know working at Saison before, and not even really thinking about it. A regular and a close friend of mine, you know, she said, she just was like, hey, you know, every time I come to Saison, you just pick a wine for us and we always love it. So like, can you just like also do that with like our wine cellar at home? And I was like, yeah, of course. Like, sure. No problem. Seems fun and pretty easy, you know? And as I did it, I was like, huh, there's like so much more to this than one thinks. And, you know, handling the logistics and the wine showing up at the right time and the right wine and the right vintage and all of these things, it kind of got some sparks in the back of my mind, flowing and just saying like, huh, like I feel like building a wine collection and one that is balanced and has things to drink now and age and is actually harder to do than what people give credit to. You just think right. that, oh, I'll go on to like, a wine website, I'll go to wine.com and say, okay, well, my cellar holds, you know, 1,000 bottles, and so I'll just go and buy 1,000 bottles, and then 120 cases of wine show up at my house, and I have to, like, somehow unpack all of these wines, and, like, I need to develop an organizational system. It's kind of
inventory.
It can be a mess sometimes. And so I was like, huh, like, I think that there's something here. I think it's relatively niche, but I would be okay with doing something like that. And after being back at Saison and getting the anglers open, I decided to kind of go out on my own and start my own thing. And I had a client or two that I had been kind of helping that I gave me a little bit of security that, you know, there was something. And so I set out, I left the restaurant. And then I started TWC, which is Thatcher's Wine Consulting. And, you know, the idea really at that point was just to make the process a little bit easier, help navigating through the wine world a little bit easier, often saying no a lot of times rather than yes, like saying like, no, I actually don't think that we should buy this wine. We should probably, you know, buy this vintage because it's drinking a little bit better and it's going to age better. And that was kind of the idea, helping with, you know, logistics when you're traveling to a city and you want some wine shipped to you and you want it at the restaurant ready to go or at the hotel, or you want to, you know, do a tasting for all of your friends, or, you know, those kind of things. You're going on a yacht and you need a bunch of wine and on your yacht and whatnot. So that was kind of the idea. And it grew like anything. And I think it's an important aspect of business. It's been something, I'm not a restless person, but I'm not a person that's ever satisfied. I always want more and more and better and better and better. And then we started after about 1 year, started the website platform. And that was really a way for us to start to carry our own inventory, which really helped in pinches when clients say, hey, I need a bottle of wine tomorrow that's like from 1991. And you're like, okay, well, we have that, so we can send that to you. Whereas before, you know, I had to call somebody or text somebody and then have them ship it, and maybe they don't have time to do it. And kind of, it was hard to react quickly. And so now, you know, carrying our own inventory kind of helped those things. And then also it allowed us to, you know, it allowed me to kind of showcase some things that I'm really excited about, whether they're new winemakers in Burgundy that are young and kind of cutting edge and really doing something incredible, or maybe a new champagne producer that's popped up, or I'm a huge fan of dry German Riesling, and I think what's happening there today is really inspiring. And so we could have all of these wines that maybe the clients that were buying or that we're collecting, you know, they have 5,000, 10,000, 50,000 bottles, were not necessarily what these producers weren't on their radar. But now we have an opportunity to put it on their radar and also share our love for these wines with the rest of people that don't have to kind of contact us and be retained and, you know, us managing their cellar. They can just go onto the site and just see what's new. And we kept it kind of boutique-y, and where the inventory is just always fluctuating and changing, and there's just new stuff. And, you know, it's been a year and a little bit now, and people seem to be having a lot of fun. And I think for me, the sign of that is when for like 5 days in a row, you see the same person making, you know, 4 purchases a day for 5 days. It just means that they're like, oh, this is cool. Like, I want to buy this. I want to buy that. Oh, what's this? I've never heard of this. And we were lucky to get it going right before COVID. So that kind of helped a bit during that crazy time and giving some more sort of security for us. And then we started the import company as well, which is brand new, just a few months old now. So called Thatcher's Imports. I thought it was fitting to go in with the name of the consulting company.
Since it is your name, I mean, you know.
Yeah, exactly. And we just want to work with, again, that same, a lot of the producers that we were really excited to put onto the site, we wanted to take that same ethos and apply it to the new producers that we're importing. So we want to work with the sort of next generation that are really passionate about agriculture, realizing that, you know, global warming is a major thing and we need to pay attention to it or else we're not going to have white Burgundy anymore, you know. And so we started that and really, you know, at this point, all three of those elements have just kind of tied into each other because everybody loves wine. The private clients are really interested in trying some of the new things. The import adds a lot of value to both aspects because it's bringing something brand new into the U.S. that's never been here before. And so that's kind of where we are today and lucky to have a really amazing team. Last year we hired Courtney, who was the wine director at The Modern in New York. So she was, you know, her passion for wine has been amazing. And then the first hire was Noah, who was the director of wine programs at Saison. And he's just like a logistical animal. It's incredible. Like he's so dialed in with everything that's going on. And so it's the three of us and we're just having a lot of fun you know, it's fun to see all of the changes that are happening in the wine world and also be a part of them.
You are based in the United States, obviously, but Switzerland and Asia also, I see here. Is that true?
Yeah, so we have clients everywhere. We have a pretty big client base, actually, in Asia, and that has come from me spending time in Japan. And Takazawa, across the street, had a little 12-seat bar called Takazawa Bar. And as I expanded the wine list pretty considerably to over 1,000 selections when I was there. And it just became this destination for people all around Asia to visit. So Singapore, Thailand, Hong Kong, Beijing. And so they would come and they'd drink wines and we just became friends. And when I went out and started doing this business, they obviously all love wine. And so they were like, well, please help me find all of these incredible things. And so we have, clients in Asia, all around the U.S., everywhere from Jacksonville to San Diego to D.C., and then a couple clients in Europe as well, which is always fun to kind of be able to go to Europe and hang out.
Visit your clients. You have a cellar, or you have a you'd say you have all these wines. Where are they? How do you store them? Give me a little bit of that.
I live in San Francisco, and then right. We have basically a warehouse, maybe 45 minutes, just in the East Bay, and that's where we store our main inventory. But we honestly have wine all around the world. It's sometimes it's a little bit like, okay, like we have wine in the UK and France, in Switzerland, in Oregon, in Chicago, in DC, in New York. There's wine everywhere, but it all eventually makes its way to California, and then we send it to the clients, or it goes onto the website, and then we kind of go from there. Everything is always kept in temperature control. I think it's really important. Wine is so sensitive, and it doesn't mean that because you leave a bottle of wine out on the counter for a few days, there's going to be anything wrong with it. But I really think that keeping the light away from the wine is really, really, really important. That not enough people think about. That's actually one of my biggest problems with, there's a lot of storage facilities that are popping up all around the U.S. And a lot of them have, racking instead of just storing things in boxes. And my biggest problem with those places are that in a public storage where you have racking, the lights are always on all the time, and it's just not good for your wine. And so if you have wine sitting at the top of this rack for years and years and years, it 99% of the time, the wine isn't going to be what it could be if it would have just been kept in a box in the dark, not touched, away from everything. But I think light is important, and then obviously temperature is important.
Well, a lot of those places, too, use fluorescent lights because it's cheaper and easier, and that's horrible for wines. People don't realize fluorescent lights is one of the worst things you can use.
Yeah, it's really terrible. Yeah, no, it's true. I mean, I think you have to try to keep as much light out as possible. And, I have a wine enthusiast cave that's, holds, a few hundred bottles, maybe 1,000 mm-hmm. bottles, I'm not sure. And when I moved in, it was the first thing that I did. I was like, well, where am I going to put this fridge so that it never sees any light, and temperature is important too. I think those two things go a long way. I mean, short term, fine. If you just keep a few things out, it's going to be okay. But if you want to kind of experience that wine 2, 3, 5, 10 years later, it really should be in temperature control.
Right. Anything over 6 months, you really should have temperature control. I mean, it's simple as that. Sake, is that part of your inventory or not yet?
No, it's not. I've tried to start a sake import company into the U.S. It's entirely possible, but it is not a – look, I could start a sake company and get sake here and sell sake, and that would be fine. But from what would make me feel good about it, it would be representing brands that know that their sake is, controlled the way that they want it to do. And I don't – it's hard to – it would basically mean that a $20 bottle of sake in Japan would be a $100 plus bottle in the U.S. because that shipping and storage would be so expensive, which I think a lot of people would pay $100, but it would not feel good to travel to Japan and be like, this bottle is $30 and I bought it for $1,000.
That doesn't
feel good. So we'll see. Maybe in the future we can figure that out, but... a lot of the clients that we have are actually really interested in sake, and we do work with a few brands to try to be like, okay, as soon as the sake enters the country, we purchase it and then, get it to them right away. And that helps to make sure that it's been stored perfectly most of the time. And so, but it hasn't been too big a part yet, but it's something that I obviously would be great to work towards.
Something you mentioned earlier, and I want a clarification because obviously I am not in the restaurant business. You mentioned one of the restaurants working from a 2-star to try to get a 3-star rating on Michelin. How does that work? How do you get a Michelin rating of 1, 2, 3, or 4-star?
The way that the Michelin guide says it, right, is like a 3-star is worth a journey for, right? Mm. A 1-star is always going to be a really incredible meal with great service. And then a 2-star is worth it, is worth a trip. But the 3-star is worth, for example, there was a restaurant in northern Sweden called Faviken. So like you have to, if you were here, I would have to fly to Stockholm, and then I would have to take a train for 4 hours, and then I'd have to drive for 3 hours to get to Faviken. So to, like, that's the journey that like is worth taking in the way that restaurant would deliver, for example. You know, what does it take to get three Michelin stars? I mean, after working in them for quite a long time, I think the most important part is consistency, and that's really what they're looking for. They're looking for it's often a tasting menu. There's very few a la carte three Michelin star restaurants. They're pretty much all tasting menus, so they want those things to be the courses to be cohesive. They want the timing to be correct. There shouldn't be long legs in between each course. The service team should be really knowledgeable. There should be at least a half decent wine list. You should be drinking out of Zaltos or Riedel or Gabriel glasses at least. The plates to be polished, the restaurant to be clean, the reservation system to be organized. I mean, just sort of like everything that every restaurant could do correctly, but don't often, but then done correctly. And that's what it is. And Michelin says the only thing that matters is what's on the plate. And I say, okay, sure, but I don't think that's just solely
wink, wink.
What it is. Yeah, exactly. Because I've had some really great street tacos, and, you know, that would be deserving of three Michelin stars if that's the case. So.
Good point. Mike, do you have any questions for Thatcher here?
I don't have really a question, but I did want to say that the Sake School of America does exist, and they do have courses. That is a possibility. But yeah, they do have quite a few advisor and the sommelier course as well. So that's what I found so far.
Oh, that's awesome. Then yeah, I mean that's such a cool thing. And I know of a few people that are getting really involved in sake in the U.S. And I think it's exciting. I think it deserves the same level of attention that, you know, something like, well, wine or beer or mezcal is becoming super popular. And so, you know, like if we're paying that much attention to these things, then, we can also do it with sake. The issue with sake is that it's usually in Japanese, which is not so easy, right? But we could also make English textbooks and, you know, guides and et cetera.
Yeah, Mike, that's a point. We'll have to get a hold of that school and see if someone won't come on the program and tell us about sake.
That would be amazing.
Very good. Enjoy
that would
it.
Be
yeah,
fun.
Thank you.
Yeah. I'll tell you what, Thatcher, before we leave here, I want you to give all of your contact information. If anybody's sitting out there listening to this program tonight and says, oh, my gosh, I really want a bottle of very good wine from this little place in Burgundy, and I wonder if Thatcher can do it. So give us your websites, give us your contact information, phone. And one other question, where do you live in San Francisco? San Francisco is my favorite city in the whole wide world. I love that city.
Is it?
Yeah,
I'm in Soma, right by the pretty close to AT&T Park.
Oh, okay, yeah. Great area there. Yeah, great area.
Super central.
Yes, it is. It's a beautiful area there. I love San Francisco. I would go there myself, but I'm not young and I'm not foolish like you who jump somewhere with no job. So.
Yeah, I don't recommend that to people.
Yeah, exactly.
just saying.
Yeah, and I'm not young anymore. I can't do it anyway. Give us all of your contact information, everything else, in case anybody is out there that wants to get in touch.
Yeah, absolutely. So super simple. The website is www.thatcherswineconsulting.com. And you're more than welcome to just send me an email. And my email is just thatcher@thatcherswineconsulting.com. Same handle for Instagram, if that's a little bit easier for you. We just tried to make it as simple as possible.
Very good. And your import company, they can do that through you, through Thatcher's Wine Consulting also. So
everything links to the site, and it has there's the the consulting side tells you a little bit about the services that we offer, whether you're just looking for a specific wine from a specific vintage, or if you're looking for some help with, you know, filling the cellar or setting some goals for yourself for that cellar. Or you can just go straight onto the wine cellar, which is just a link on the page. And then it has all of the offerings that are kind of forever changing and just some really incredible wines from some really great producers that we're always really excited about.
And you, obviously, from what I've heard, you are primarily French, Burgundy, Bordeaux, that area there, more so than anywhere else then.
Definitely. I mean, Burgundy is number one for us, and it, honestly, if because Burgundy is such a complicated region, it's really honestly why I have a job. It's the region that people need help with the most because it's so complicated. It's also, you know, that's my heart is Burgundy. But then we also have a massive selection of champagnes. As I said before, I love German Riesling. Dry German Riesling is incredible. There's a bunch of great wines from Italian or from Italy, some really hard to find stuff. We didn't forget about the sweet wines because I think that that stuff is important that people sometimes don't give credit to. The Northern Rhone is something I'm really passionate about, of course, Bordeaux. But yeah, mostly it's almost entirely old world. And then once in a while we'll list, I think some of the stuff from the 50s, 60s, 70s from Napa is truly incredible. So when we can find some, 70s and 80s Diamond Creek or Inglenook, we'll put that on the site because in a blind setting, you'll think it's Bordeaux always.
They will rival anything from the old world. Yeah. Oh, yeah. No doubt.
They're incredible. They're really incredible.
Yeah. Yeah, I lived in San Francisco, or actually in Concord over the bay, in the mid to late 70s and spent a lot of time up in Napa. And those were some exciting times for wine there. It was just an incredible amount of great wines coming out of there. So,
No, it's amazing. I can't believe it.
Thank you so much for taking your time. Well, this afternoon for you, tonight for us. But thank you so much for taking your time, and what an exciting life. I mean, you've been bouncing back and forth across Canada and over the ocean and across the United States and everything, and you're young yet, so you've got lots of traveling yet to do. So,
No, thank you for having me. It was super fun to chat, and I hope we can share some wine and or sake sometime soon.
That sounds fantastic. I will definitely put that on my to-do list. So, again, thank you for taking your time tonight, and hopefully talk to you sometime in the future.
Sounds great. Have a great rest of your night.
You too now. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. There they are.
I just noticed that you dropped twice here. What happened?
Oh, yeah. Oh, I was going along. The first time it was like automatic, and I was just, I heard a, boop, and I go, oh, that wasn't good. And so I recalled. And then, I don't know, somewhere, I think it was during the sake talk, you started garbling, and then I couldn't hear anybody, but I could hear, like, every once in a while, just like, blah, 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 and I was like, oh, this ain't good. So I said, I don't hear you all, and I
didn't
get a response.
No, so I didn't hear you.
Time for me to disconnect, so I disconnected and called back again. I was like, oh, my gosh. But so Facebook and YouTube now, they might have missed about a minute's worth. But, back on and had to
I was on the site where it was, his profile, and I was following with that. And that's why I was bringing up stuff there. Yeah. And so I didn't go back to the studio page here until just now. Yeah. And then I noticed that you had – dropped twice. I'm like, what? Where? Why? Yeah.
Things up there.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, things up there. Good. That was very enjoyable.
That was. What an exciting life that young man has had. 30 years old, and he has, traveled all over the place.
All over. Experienced all a lot of different cultures and everything. I wish a lot of people could do that.
Food is the basis for it. Yeah, Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yep.
So.
Fantastic. Cool.
All right. Oh, yeah. And by the way, our listeners are still out there, but I want to tell you this too. I saw that program on Netflix that you were Rotten.
Oh.
And
Rotten,
on
yeah.
Wine. Yeah, that was that was interesting. That
kind of eye opening. That you know, it was like that. I didn't realize it. You know.
Yeah, I didn't. That was an interesting program. I was quite impressed. I'm going, whoa, is there some way we can, you know, tell all of our listeners about this? Because that was very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah.
And another thing, too, well, which is not about wine, yeah. but I just last night on Nova on PBS, there was a show about electric airplanes that you might really enjoy. About the research going into it and about what's happening with electric airplanes and about all the test flights and everything else. So it's just PBS Nova. And
I didn't realize that was I'll look that up. Yeah.
Yeah, that was definitely. On. You'll enjoy that.
I've read about it and, you know, I've seen some developments in that. Wow, that's interesting.
Yeah.
I think we're still a ways off, but, you know, they've been testing things already. So
they're saying some of them are looking at starting up next year.
Yeah.
Yeah, little, you know, taxi service and stuff like that, you know, little short routes and stuff. So, little hops. You'll enjoy that, though. I was thinking about you during the show, but just PBS Nova. It was something electric planes, something. I don't remember the actual title, but it's easy enough to find. So
yeah, I'll look it up. Cool, thank you. It's a good, good thing. It's a, people probably don't realize, why is he talking about airplanes? Well, that's an interest of mine. So
yeah, it's one of Mike's passions there. Yeah. So all right, so we are done this week. The next week we are into June. Oh my gosh.
Wow. Yep, it'll be June the 3rd.
Third, yeah.
Yeah, our next show. Doesn't look like we have any guests lined up yet, but just in case, we'll let you know.
No, but we do have one coming up on the 24th of June, so it's a little bit away, but still, though, we have a guest coming up on the 24th, so that's something to keep in mind. And then, you know... send me that link for that Sake program.
Sake School. It's just Sake. Yeah, I'll send it to you, but it's
send it to me.
Sake School of America.com.
There you go.
Yeah, I'll send that to you.
And anybody who is a sake enthusiast, you know, be fun to have you on the show, so let us know.
Yeah.
And I'll try to get a hold of the Sake School of America and see if there's someone there that would be willing to come on and talk to us about it. So,
interesting.
That would be.
All right. We will close it out for this evening. And thank you all again for tuning in. We will talk to you next week on June the 3rd at 7 p.m. Eastern Time. Or if you listen to the archives, that's fine. We understand. And
we do.
So, have a great week and be safe. And happy Memorial Day! Is it?
Oh yeah, that Monday. Yeah, I guess happy. What would you say?
I heard it's not, but it's a federal. For those who don't know, it's a federal holiday in the United States, honoring and mourning the military personnel who died. During
the ultimate sacrifice for the service of our country.
Yes.
That's the term that I've heard used quite a lot.
Remembrance, unfortunately there's a lot of people who will go out and like use it as a celebration day and, you know, without thinking about
the underlying meaning.
So that's it. So,
but there's a lot of meaning behind it, like Mike was just saying. Yeah.
Yeah, there's more to it than a vacation day.
Hot dogs and beer.
Yes. I miscued that, and I was like, oh, happy. And then I thought about it, and I go, wait, no, it's Memorial Day.
I know. And so we default to the happy on any holiday so easily.
Yeah, every holiday.
Happy.
Happy day of the dead. You know what's that one in October, November? Happy day of the dead. All right, we appreciate it.
This past week, too, I noticed somebody posted Lee Spann, as a matter of fact, you know who I'm talking about, the weather girl for the station here. Lee posted that it was National Wine Day last Monday? Monday or Tuesday, was it?
Yeah, I think it was like 2 days ago. Yeah. Tuesday, That Monday,
Tuesday. So National Wine Day, and I tried to get on our Facebook page and post it, and my Facebook came up and said, we need a password. And then it wouldn't take it and said, I haven't used it. So I never did. I mean, the point being, I never did post it. But a couple of days ago was National Wine Day.
Wow. Totally. Oh, well. We'll try next year.
That's right. Or in 6 months when another one comes up and it's National Wine Day.
Yeah.
Always seems to be something. National Cabernet Day, National Merlot Day, National Pinot Noir, National Chardonnay. Mm-hmm. National red wine, national white wine.
We should have a National Sake Day.
They probably do.
That'll be next.
That way.
Could be.
So
we'll see you next Thursday, 7 p.m. Eastern time. Thank you for tuning in. Have a great week and be safe.
Thanks
safe
for tuning
weekend.
In. See you next week.
All right. Thank you. This concludes
tonight's broadcast of All About Wine with your host, Ron. For show information, links to All About Wine on Twitter and Facebook, or to be a guest on the show, visit the show website at www.allaboutwinebtr.com. Archived shows are available for download on iTunes or on our show page at blogtalkradio.com/allaboutwine. Thank you for listening. Drink responsibly, and we'll see you next time on All About Wine.